Hello, and welcome to another episode of Narrative for Social Justice. Following last episode's focus on neuroqueer narratives, especially about autism, this week we are continuing the conversation about neurodiversity by focusing on ADHD. Our guests today are Rebecca Shapiro, Catherine Trotman, and Lee Scalert-Bissett, all of whom are part of Rebecca's group ADHD and Academy. I'll let them introduce themselves, including their relationship to the topic of ADHD. So Rebecca, could you start us off?
It's only my group in the sense that I am the one who is sort of most neurotypical or least ADHD-like. And so I'm really good with calendars and organizing things. And so I started this because it's sort of an offshoot of the way that I've been doing mentoring with the American Society for 18th Century Studies group. There was this huge lack of mentoring going on, and I realized that we could be doing something. And because it was volunteer, the organizer said, sure, you can do whatever you want. We'll give you a space, but don't ask for anything else. And we're like, okay, fine, then we'll do whatever we want. And so I was doing that for a couple of years, and then the pandemic started and like everything else seemed to stop. Let me back up briefly. I know Catherine because I was stuck in Barbados when the island closed its borders. She's at the University of the West Indies. And what I did when I was stuck, in order to not go crazy, I found some like-minded people, on academics and friends on Zoom, who would want to have like a daily or, you know, every other day writing or, you know, work meeting, because all of a sudden everything was canceled, everything was shut down. I was on sabbatical. I'm like, oh my God. And so I found people on Zoom who would work and, you know, check in and, you know, create this like really supportive group. So I was doing some really great work with people on Zoom, and I finally was repatriated home, and I saw my husband struggling to get that kind of connection and community. While I was teaching in Barbados at the University of the West Indies, that was working really well. And then I came back and I was teaching at the City University of New York, and I still needed to maintain that you know, connection, and that managed to kind of come back with me. But I saw my friends, some of my friends and colleagues, and my husband, who is ADHD, really struggling trying to create a network, a group, good, you know, habits in the absence of all kinds of structure. And then another friend of mine who teaches at Fordham was losing her mind, going, you know, with all of this like online and this, and she still had to write her dissertation. And I thought, okay, if I'm having a nightmare experience during COVID and I'm really good at organizing, imagine what it must be like for other, you know, people who aren't so good at this. I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but I guess I put it out on Twitter saying, hey, if you've got ADHD and you're an academic, would you like to have like a monthly meeting where you just kind of check in and see how things are going and know that there are other people like you? That was really helpful. And the very first meeting was, there were like 25, 30 people there. And it was incredibly emotional. I introduce things and let people kind of take over, and I would sort of move things a bit, but I started crying because it was so emotional and people were so kind of grateful to know that there was like another one of their species, you know, you know, like when babies meet each other, like, and it was like that, where the people were like, wow, I do this too. You mean this isn't, you know, X, Y, and Z? It was wonderful seeing, you know, the idea of like normal get kind of put on its head, because what's normal for someone with ADHD is completely confusing for people who, you know, don't have it. Shortly after, another member of the group created a Discord channel, and there are all sorts of, you know, like little like links and, you know, like rooms and chat capabilities. And it's actually been really helpful to me because I remember one time this fall, I was completely stuck writing a paper. I went into the Discord space and I'm like, somebody help. And somebody was like, sure, do this. This is what happens when I do that. So I've taken up some of the ideas that and tricks of the trade that people with ADHD have. So I've been very lucky.
Yeah, it's amazing how you've been able to kind of connect your professional interest and then your interest in mentorship and, of course, living with a spouse as well and seeing them struggling. Lee, did you want to introduce yourself next?
I got my ADHD diagnosis pretty comparatively late. This isn't actually all that surprising. It is very much missed in women because the way we think of ADHD, we think of hyperactive little boys, not forgetful little girls. You know, there's a whole, we could talk about that when we talk about the social justice issue for sure. But my son was diagnosed with ADHD, and that was also unexpected because, again, we were stuck in that sort of stereotype of what ADHD looks like. And my son was not hyperactive. He was very attentive. You know, he was struggling in school, you know, very bright, very nice. Again, like this, I was like, he's so nice and he's so bright and he works hard, but, you know, couldn't pay attention. And then, you know, finally took him to a therapist. And within 5 minutes, she said, has anybody ever diagnosed him with ADHD? Has anybody in your family have ADHD? And he said, no. And she's like, well, I think he has it. And he did. And I, of course, being the academic that I am, started reading extensively about it. I started recognizing myself when I was a kid and even myself now, also recognizing it in my daughter. You know, ended up getting my own diagnosis. I had previously had bouts with depression and anxiety. And that is often how ADHD ends up presenting itself in women because we've internalized that perfectionism. You know, if I just worked harder, if I just tried harder, if I just applied myself, I'd be able to do all of these things that I'm not good at. And then, so finally got that ADHD diagnosis. A good friend of mine, she also got a diagnosis around the same time as I did, actually, of ADHD and autism. We got together and decided we were going to make a podcast and just talk about it. You know, two women in their 40s who found out later that all of these things that we thought were wrong with us, so to speak, were actually because of our ADHD and or autism. And so we get together once a week during the semester when we can, and we record our episodes and we release them every Friday. We just had one come out today. It's Friday today. This morning we're talking about surviving the holidays at the moment. It's been really revelatory just in terms of having a much better understanding of the things that I've struggled with. You know, just sort of running through the list of all of those things that, you know, I could never get quite right. And also that feeling fitting in and knowing that I didn't think the way others thought, or my brain didn't work the way others' brains worked, not understanding why or how that was. And so now even just having the language to be able to describe it. And that's one of the best things, the best results of the podcast is that, you know, having people reach out to us and tell us that hearing about our experience and talking about it, people coming back and saying, you gave us the language, you gave us the terminology, that's been really meaningful. And so it's we regularly hear from listeners about how helpful the podcast has been in terms of explaining to themselves, right, what things are, but also explaining to loved ones, right? Here, listen to this.
I can't recommend the podcast enough. It's called All the Things ADHD. And it is a very informative and but also like a super fun podcast too. It's really fun to listen to. Catherine, what about you?
Hi, yeah. So I'm a clinical psychologist. I lecture at the University of the West Indies here in Barbados at Cave Hill. So that's where I'm from, where I am at the moment, sunny Barbados. And I also do some work at our hospital here. Most of my work is in trauma. But similar to Lee, I have ADHD and I was diagnosed quite late in life. I was actually diagnosed while I was doing my doctorate. One of the interesting things about my diagnosis is that I was quite annoyed with how often we were labeling children with ADHD when I was doing my placement with children. And I said to my supervisor, you know, I understand that we want to help kids and so on, but I do think we have to be careful. And she said, well, yeah, you might think that, but that's probably because you've also got ADHD. And I was like, what? I have ADHD. She was like, oh, you should probably get evaluated. And I did. And we found out that, like Lee said, you know, most women that aren't diagnosed when they are young have that inattentive subtype of ADHD, and that fit me to a T. Constantly got my report cards saying fun things like needs to apply herself more, does not live up to potential. And my grades were pretty good. It was usually A's, occasional B's, but they were still saying, you know, pay attention, Catherine, like come back to us. Where have you gone? And so that has really, really helped that diagnosis and having words, like Lee said, for what has been going on with me for my entire life. And again, similar to what Lee said, I struggled with depression for a long time because, you know, I can do the work. I understand the work. It makes sense. Why can't I sit down and finish it? And so I was on medication for depression for about 9 years. Having a diagnosis, having that language has really made a difference for me. And I think talking a bit more about it, especially within my cultural context, where we don't necessarily look at neurotypicality unless it is quite intense.
Thank you for sharing that, Catherine. So just to kind of flesh out once again, so Rebecca is a professor and Lee is working in educational development, and both of you are in the States. And Catherine works as a psychologist inside and outside of the academy in Barbados. But it's interesting that despite all these kinds of positions, you've all traced out how ADHD does not respect personal and professional boundaries. Myself, I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto in English. I do not have ADHD, but I'm really interested in this topic because I've seen colleagues and friends struggle with this. And more broadly, I've seen a huge emphasis on attention as a moral and intellectual virtue in the academy. It harms everybody, honestly, whether you have ADHD or not. It especially harms those who have ADHD and are considered neurodiverse. But really, it's harmful to a lot of people. It's very normative. It's very restrictive. It's not culturally sensitive. I got to work in educational development as a baby educational developer. When the pandemic started, it opened my eyes to how deeply inaccessible the university is and how this is an issue related to ADHD, of course, that there's a lot of barriers to accessing accommodations, that even accommodations themselves, the way that they're still very individualized, it's not helping my peers, it's not helping my students. And so that's kind of why I'm interested in this topic. I've noticed a couple of threads about social justice come up already. So I think we can just jump there. Some issues about diagnosing women and girls and why it gets missed. We've already brought up the kind of moral issues around it. I found it interesting and very sad when Lee brought up about how her son, because he's so nice and kind, and because he's smart, how could he possibly have ADHD? Because if you have ADHD, I guess you can't be any of those things. Catherine brought up the cultural context in which we talk about ADHD can make it more stigmatizing or easier to miss.
I would like to bring up something also. You're talking about focus and attention. One of the things that I've watched my husband experience was having to retire as an associate professor because he was never able to get promoted to full because he had never written a full-length book because, of course, he couldn't focus. He could not maintain that for years and years and years. And yet he managed, by the time he retired, to have something like 40 articles, but the university didn't value the number of pages published. So that docked him, you know, in his career. Institutions not being able to recognize that people have different ways of doing things is really also frustrating. The number of times his work has gone up for peer review far exceeds what it would have been had he just published a book, and yet that didn't count. And so his career was stunted, and ultimately his earning power, which affected his ability to retire on a certain amount of income. Granted, he, you know, has a nice job, you know, doing whatever he wants in retirement now, but because of the university's policies being very inflexible, it really made a difference on his career and also the way he felt about his institution. That's a social justice thing as well, how we need to be able to find alternative ways of success.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the reasons. I mean, I have a PhD in comparative literature. I was intending on doing a tenure track job. But one of the things, one of the challenges is that I was, in sort of true ADHD fashion, a generalist, because everything was interesting to me. You know, I did manage to turn my dissertation into a book. But again, it was, you know, when you have to do that narrative on the job letter, it was really hard to do that narrative because I struggled to make sense of to a hiring committee in academia what my career trajectory was and why I would fit for this very highly specialist job when, you know, my publication record in no way, shape or form reflected a high specialist. And I in educational development before I got my diagnosis, but it makes a lot of sense because, you know, there it's always changing. It's, you know, I'm also an extrovert, so I get to work with people. I get that those sort of intense relationships with faculty and developing their courses, nerding out and hearing about their research and what they're teaching. But there's still enough structure to it. Like, we love our calendars much more in staff or admin positions than we ever did as faculty, right? But also I think there is, on the other side of it, is that if I was still in a traditional academic position, I don't think I would be doing the podcast necessarily, because that doesn't count. But, you know, it was the same thing. I was a prolific blogger for a while and blogged on a higher education publication. But again, that wasn't scholarly and it wasn't academic enough. But again, you know, and my co-host Amy is in a privileged position. It's like, she has tenure, so she can kind of say the same things. I'm going to do what I want and I want to do a podcast. And, you know, part of it is also her field is communications. So, you know, it fits within that. But there is this freedom that I have now as an alt-ac or staff member or academic developer, where I can choose where I publish and what I want to publish on, while basically it's only evidence that I can communicate, right? That's what they want to see evidence of. Can you do communications to various audiences? And can you still do some research, but then communicate that research in different ways? Because that's actually a really important skill as an educational developer, because you are dealing with across disciplines and various audiences in that sort of sense. You know, I think it's been really good, but it's just, again, unfortunate that in academia, it takes being in a non-faculty role to be able to actually have that freedom and to have that kind of privilege to be able to do all of this work and have it count, right? And have it be meaningful, you know, both to the academy, but also, you know, just having more of an impact. And again, I think that's another part that we don't think about, is that what I'm doing and my public writing and my podcasting and speaking openly about having ADHD and neurodiversity had a much greater impact than any of my academic essays. You know, I don't get emails the way I do from the podcast saying, like, thank you for doing this, right? This is the same sort of thing about that, what the academy values. I mean, it's not just neurotypical, it's also sexist, it's also racist. It's, you know, it is still the white man with somebody at home taking care of the kids in a very academic kind of writing and style of scholarship that issues orality, issues experimentation, issues you know, the possibility of a neurodivergent standpoint. One of the most fun things that I've done is I was invited by the digital rhetoric and composition journal Kairos to create something that reflected my experience as a writer with ADHD. And it was in the interviews part. So I was like, oh, I can interview myself. And it's a born digital. So they want you to sort of embrace the affordances of the web. And they're like, we don't just want like text on a screen. Like, this is an online journal, you know, lean into that. So I did. And I took this platform called Twine, which allows you to choose your own adventure stories. You can pick your path through a narrative. And so it's hypertext. So you can pick your path through the hypertext, but you can also add images, add sound, add video, add sort of effects to it, because again, it's a born digital publication. It was so much fun because it was the first time in my writing that I ever have really leaned into the ADHD as an author, right? I'm usually trying to like, don't want to alienate the readers, can't make this too ADHD, you know, can't be too all over the place. And I'm like, no, this is all about side quests. This is nothing but side quests. So I had it that, so I set it up that there's an order to it that I sort of, and say, okay, there's a beginning, middle, and an end, even if it doesn't look like a beginning, middle, and an end to you. But I also did it that you can click on whatever you want to move your way through it, or I have a random button. And so I've got distracting noises in the background. I have ones that like repeat themselves over and over. I have ones that I read over it. I have ones that it's just like flashing images. And I do sort of give a warning at the beginning and say, hey, look, if you want the full experience, here's what you need to do. Turn up your volume. If that's too much for you, don't do it with the volume on. But at the same time, you know, I could kind of say, look, if I really want the reader to understand the experience, or at least my experience of having ADHD, it's going to be annoying. It's going to be flashy. It's going to be confusing. It's going to be disorienting. So I really had fun leaning into that and just like telling and showing and telling in a way that I'd never been able to before. Cause usually, like, especially when I was blogging, I would occasionally blog in that way. And the pushback I would get from the readers was like, this doesn't make any sense. How is she even blogging about this? You call yourself an academic, you call yourself a writing teacher. I've never wanted you to teach, you know, your students how to write. You clearly can't write yourself. But now again, it's being published in their spring journal issue. And I'm really excited to have it out there, because it's like, I think it might be one of the pieces of writing that I'm most proud of, but at the very least I can say that it's the piece of writing that is the most me, which is something I didn't think I'd ever be able to say. Right. And so to have this opportunity, it was really special and really liberating. Again, in that idea of social justice is opportunities to be able to articulate and have those moments where we can express the fullness of the ADHD experience, for better or for worse, and to help others understand that. Because one of the things that, particularly women, there's that pressure to mask and to repress and to feel shame around it in particular is, you know, Catherine, I the exact same thing, right? If you would just apply yourself, if you would just try a little harder, if you would just, you know, any of these kinds of things. And then to sort of be able to say, no, it's not a question of effort. This is the reality of my experience. This is how I process the world. This is how, you know, I tell stories differently, you know, again, with all the side quests, which is my favorite thing that I saw in an ADHD meme. It's like, we're nothing but side quests. So just being able to do all of that and to be able to talk more openly about it, I think is a really important first step, because there is so much shame. There is so much stigma attached to you know, Angela, you said it, right? It's like being able to pay attention, not just in the academy, but generally, right? Like we, all of the rhetoric right now about how phones are ruining our attention and TV is ruining our attention and, you know, Twitter is ruining our attention. And I was like, my attention was ruined long ago, but that how sometimes that's bad. One of the best things that I've read, and it's not necessarily about ADHD, but it reframed for me long before I got the diagnosis was Now You See It by Kathy Davidson. And it was all about the science of attention. And it was just sort of like, she's saying like, we just need to calm down. Like, it's just, we're different. The circumstances when are different and there's such thing as neuroplasticity and we're adapting for better or worse. We're adapting and we can figure out ways that this is actually better than the way things were. And I really kind of embrace that, particularly as an educator. So like even before I got the diagnosis, I thought it was really important in my role as an educator to really encourage my students to do their best work in the best way that they could. Because I always knew that my way that I did work wasn't the same way as everybody else's. And if I tried to do it the way everybody said you should do it, it was bad. Like it was crap work. And so even before the diagnosis, understanding that I have a certain way of doing things and it works really well for me, but I know that that doesn't necessarily work for everyone. And so, you know, working with students to be like, okay, how do we, you know, you're struggling with writing the essay. Okay, why? How do we work this? How do we fix it? Is it that it's too quiet? Is it that it's too loud? Do you need to speak it first and do a draft orally first and have it transcribed and then go back and edit it? And just really having that openness to try and figure out alternative strategies so that, you know, so that people can be successful.
Yeah, a lot of things to pick up. So both Rebecca and Lee obviously are very familiar with the conventions of academic writing, and both of you kind of put forth this idea of writerly passing, or, you know, being able to produce a monograph, which is still the gold standard to get tenure. And I think both of you also in different ways poked at this idea of how neurodiversity is really not welcome in the academy. I mean, the academy is nominally celebrating diversity, but it's still very specific about what those forms of diversity are. Catherine, I'm curious about in your experience studying psychologists, but also, you know, before that kind of getting the diagnosis and in your profession, do you also have similar experiences about being judged about what counts as meaningful work in your context?
I think absolutely. So I'm a bit more of a baby academic than people who are more established in their profession. I've been working in mental health for about 10 years now as a psychologist, but I've only been in academia for a couple of years. I actually started teaching that September before COVID hit. And so I had spent a significant amount of time working with people with ADHD, working with people who are not neurotypical. But I think for me, my big issue has been COVID related. My coping skills have all been about going to a big busy place. So coffee shops and libraries and outside and lots of people around me, because if I get understimulated, my brain is gonna find something to hold on to. And she's gonna just take a lovely walk far away from whatever I'm doing. I like that overstimulation. So I actually first started taking ADHD medication when the pandemic hit and when my country went into lockdown. So I spent a very frantic couple of months trying to write quietly in my house and just not getting anything done at all, really, really struggling, getting very depressed, getting very anxious, being entirely sure I was going to be fired at any moment because I wasn't producing what I needed to be producing. And I think it's only now, 2 years later, that I'm really started to get back on track as an academic. That's never happened to me before in practice, because practice is very different. It's about having the person in front of you, talking to them. It's an active thing. It's very difficult to get distracted when there's somebody in front of you talking. It moves every, you know, you have 40 minutes with one person and then you get to disengage and go to somebody else. But academia is a completely different world. I do think that my university is very good when it comes to things like student services. They are very happy to put things in place for students that are struggling. And so we have students on campus who have physical disabilities. They might have mental health differences. They might have neurotypical issues, and the university does try very hard to accommodate them. That said, I'm not sure how much we really do for staff who have those sort of issues. I think by the time you've gotten your PhD and you're working full time, they expect you to just kind of be able to handle it, to figure it out yourself. You know, you're a big girl, put on your big girl pants and pay attention. And that's just not as easy for some people as it is for others. So that's sort of the challenge that I've been having the last couple of years, both being a baby academic and being a baby academic with ADHD who is very extroverted now in a global pandemic. Been a challenging couple of years. I'm not really sure where we're going to go with this or how we're going to make accommodations for people with those issues. But things like this, starting to talk about it, it's a big help.
I think something about the pandemic, and I'm certain that all the things ADHD has probably touched on this, that it seems to me that people came undone when they realized that they could not focus as well during the pandemic, and that because of that, they could not produce as much. And then I imagine that a lot of people who have had chronic problems with attention were like, well, we've been dealing for this for years and just shouting into a void for help. I'm not trying to minimize the kinds of challenges that people went through in the pandemic, but it was, I mean, it really showed people how scary it is, how emotionally devastating it can be to lose your ability to focus on something. Yeah, I wonder if you see any conversations changing around that. I'm also thinking about how, and of course this is not a new issue, but we've just seen massive racial reckonings during the time, and having, I am located in one of the most culturally and racially diverse cities in North America. And I do not expect that when India was having problems with vaccination, that my students with family there could focus on their coursework. That's just ludicrous. Or that, you know, when some other events were happening, that, you know, my Asian, Black, Indigenous students, that they would feel motivated to write an essay or to even show up to class. It just didn't make any sense. That's not exactly an ADHD issue, but it having that context for talking about ADHD just shows that, you know, that attention, who gets to pay attention, who gets to have focus at any given moment, is a social justice issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that has been positive coming out of the pandemic is that a lot of people have been struggling with their mental health. It has kind of changed the mentality here in the Caribbean away from an us versus them mentality. So it's less us, the people who are mentally healthy, and them, the people who need help. And more like, well, with an extreme situation, with any difficult situation, you know, that could be me. I can see myself having periods of depression. I can see myself having periods of anxiety. There are periods where I haven't been able to concentrate. I've tried really, really hard. I've drank a lot of coffee. I've put on calming music. I've done all the right things, and I still can't focus. What's happening? What's wrong with me? We're seeing this massive shift in terms of moving towards mental health. So my university has started having, University of the West Indies has started to have all of these mental health talks. HR has been putting on, you know, coping with change, coping with anxiety, coping with depression, coping with loss of focus, really looking at how we have mental health on a spectrum. From week to week, you can be at different ends of that spectrum depending on what's happening with you. We're in a culture that really does stigmatize, and this here in the Caribbean, in Barbados, really does stigmatize people with mental health issues. It's not something we talk about very openly. People won't say if they're going to therapy. We very often have to pretend that it's something else. We still, up to very recently, worked on the asylum model of mental health. And so that shift has been very, very important and very meaningful. I'm lucky to work with young people, and you're seeing the way that they talk about mental health has really changed. So we're seeing compassion there a lot more than judgment. And I think that's been a beautiful thing to come out of the pandemic.
From my perspective, because I don't have ADHD, I can ask questions and request information that other people can't. So a couple of weeks ago, we were having, you know, a monthly meeting, and we were talking about, well, I wasn't, but other people were talking about what it would be like to disclose ADHD status to administrators or department chairs or the university. Almost nobody was willing to disclose, and especially a couple of the younger colleagues who were either adjuncts or assistant professors. At the same time, there's this acknowledgement and attempt to try to normalize, you know, the that is sort of a lower level way of addressing things, but at the upper levels, things are less likely to move and change. So I asked on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, who had or whose universities had made changes in terms of like stopping the tenure clock or allowing people to revise or do things differently with their annual reports, or how they could recategorize any kind of work that they've done. The answer that I got almost to a single one was, we did something the first semester, like spring of 2020, and then things are back the way that they used to be for the university, but nobody else is back to the way that we used to be. The reality is what we're dealing with and what Catherine is talking about. And then there's the administrative things that just are at iceberg speed and would have to go through all kinds of levels of change and, you know, committee work and things like that. So hopefully at some point these are going to, you know, be better aligned. We'll see what happens in the next year or so to people who've managed to do interesting and good things, and yet they're not quite making sense to the academy.
And I think that the other part, like this idea of disclosing, and I'm sort of in an ALTAC position, I'm in a secure one. And what's really interesting is the reaction of people, where I'm just like, yes, I have ADHD and I have been on depression medication. And you know, it's not anything that I don't talk about on Twitter. It's not anything I haven't blogged about. It's not like it's some huge secret. I'm very open about my ADHD. I have previously been very open about my depression and anxiety. I've been open on Twitter about it. I've been open on my blog about it. And yet still, if I'm in a room in person and say, oh, by the way, I have ADHD and here are my limitations, here's how I work around it, but also here is something that you should understand about how I behave in meetings. I don't look like I'm paying attention, but I'm trying to, you know, I'm stimming instead to be able to focus. And there's just this huge level of discomfort that people have when I disclose. It's interesting that when it's online me, it's like they can keep it at arm's reach and sort of separate the me that's standing in front of them with the me that is online or on podcasts or, you know, all of that. And again, I think it's internalized, a lot of the times internalized ableism, where I'm not supposed to be as comfortable as I am with ADHD, but you can't have ADHD because you're so successful. We did a whole podcast episode about that, Amy and I, but you're so successful. How could you have ADHD? Or I wrote one, I used to work with, who discovered the podcast and who messaged me and said, oh gosh, I thought it was just me struggling. You always seem to have it so together. And I can't, you know, I can't believe it. And I was like, sorry, not only was I undiagnosed when I was working there, but I was also in the throes of one of the worst depressive episodes I've ever had, where like you didn't know that I was crying in the car to and from work every single day. There's this, we want to talk about it more, but there is still this really huge discomfort with speaking about it. And people are still uncomfortable when you're comfortable with it, right? Where I'm not apologetic about having ADHD. Right? I'm not apologetic about having depression. I'm unapologetic about it. And I'm not in their face with it, but it's just like, I'm direct. I advocate. I explain. I don't keep it a secret or hide it or feel shameful about it. And that's not what the expected narrative is. And so I think that there is more of an openness to talk about it, but we still have a long way to go to like really think about acceptance, because those narratives are so deeply entrenched over how we're supposed to talk about neurodiversity. It's, you know, and even in myself, right? Like, it's not like this happened overnight for me. There's still stuff that I struggle with it as well.
I was just going to note that I have a sometimes similar experience with disclosure. I haven't sat down with anybody in my organization and said, oh, I've got ADHD, largely because I'm not sure that anyone would care. I don't think it's something that anyone would care about in any positive way. You know, like if you said you have a physical ailment or a different mental health ailment, people might say, okay, well, what can we do to help you with that? But here, most people aren't even really sure if it's a real thing. You know, we're still in that mentality where we're like, you have ADHD. Well, you know, maybe your parents should have been a bit stricter when you were a kid, so you'd sit down and behave yourself. So we have a very, very different way of looking at it. And my own parents, I mean, my father is blatantly ADHD. He's a doodler and a mover, and he can't sit still, and he's all over the place having a lovely time. Lovely man. And I'm very different to my siblings. There are four of us. But even knowing that, and knowing that I was very different to my other siblings, neurodivergence does run in family. So I have a sister who has dyslexia, and that seemed more of a real physical thing. So she had gotten treatment for that quite young and is doing brilliantly now. But even knowing that, you know, I was quite different to my peers, and I was quite distracted, and I wasn't a bad kid, but I never really paid a lot of attention to things, you know, leave cupboard doors open and make a cup of tea and forget about it and then make six more cups of tea. Even with all of that, my parents are still, and like I said, my dad definitely has ADHD. My parents are still, you know, okay, maybe you don't concentrate very well, but I don't think you have a disorder. I don't think there's anything actually wrong. I think you just need to buckle down and concentrate. And that's just very much how it is. So I haven't not disclosed to academia because I am worried about backlash. I just haven't disclosed because I don't see the point. I talk about it with my students occasionally if we are doing a module that looks at neurodivergence, but I just don't think it'll make a difference if I do talk about it at work to my colleagues.
I think the way the disclosure is represented is still very much that it is the revealing of a secret. But as Lee kind of pointed out, sometimes disclosing something is sometimes because it is not a secret, or that it is not treated as a secret. It's information, and that the keeping of it is not the keeping of a secret that needs to be hidden. I have lots of students who, you know, will tell me that they just got an ADHD diagnosis or something because they want me to help them with their learning. And maybe the accommodations process is going to take way too long, or the bureaucracy is just way too Byzantine. So a lot of them, that, you know, there's absolutely no shame and no lead up.
I ended up sad but necessary and interesting conversation with my son after he got his diagnosis, you know, and he was 8, 9, not very old. And he was processing. There was a lot going on. He had broken his arm, and there was just like so much going on with him, which was part of how we got the diagnosis, was that there was just so much going on that he couldn't mask it. And he was really struggling. And so there was just, it was a period of just so much for him. So he gets the diagnosis, we start medication, he's going to school. It, you know, it just sort of trusted him, and you know, we talked about it and those kinds of things. And I said, you can tell people or not tell people, it's up to you. And he told one of his friends, and his friend told everyone. And my son came home and was just an absolute wreck, right? Like, he betrayed, and just, you know, that internalized shame, even at that age, that he had about it. And I told him, I said, look, there's a difference. I'm getting choked up. There's a difference between wanting to keep things private and needing to keep things a secret, where it's fine if you don't want to tell anyone, right? You can keep things private. But to say that it's okay that you don't have to tell anyone, right? In terms of your own privacy and level of comfort, it's not the same thing as feeling like you need to keep it a secret, because there's the shame that's attached to that if we think we have to keep it a secret. You know, I mean, I said, think about that and just really think about, are you trying to keep this private or are you trying to keep this a secret because you're ashamed or afraid and these kinds of things. And it really stuck with him. But what ended up being great about it is that he goes to school the next day, we talk about it. I said, it's okay. You know, the principal who, you know, I also coach swimming and I would coach the principal's kids in swimming. And so the principal knew our family fairly well. And the principal went and talked to him and said, you know, I have ADHD too. But then he found out that like four of his good friends also had ADHD. Another one of his friends was in therapy, like just all of these things that felt comfortable talking about, or nobody thought they could talk about or should talk about. Suddenly they were talking about it, and they were talking about it openly, not necessarily loudly, but within their, at least their friend group. Suddenly there was this commonality that they didn't even know that they had. And so it was this whole new avenue that opened up to them in terms of just understanding each other. And so it's something that we've tried to keep thinking about is this difference between privacy and secrecy. I want to respect their privacy, right? And I want my kids to understand boundaries and what they want to keep private and what they want to be public. But at the same time, thinking about, well, what's with the secrecy, right? Why are we doing this as a secret? And so it's a really, particularly in the internet age, where everybody's like, kids don't have any privacy. I'm like, no, they have really deep-seated ideas about privacy and boundaries. They're just different from ours. We older generations have conflated privacy and secrecy entirely too much. A lot of the times what we say we want to keep it private is because we want to keep it a secret because there's so much shame attached to it. And I think that there's that change that needs to happen around how we talk about a lot of different things, among them mental health, neurodivergence, ADHD, autism, all of those kinds of things.
I like that, you know, your son was able to talk about that openly. And I think we do have to remember, though, that is, to be able to talk about something like that openly is quite a privilege, because, you know, he obviously goes to a school where children have access to psychology, they have access to therapy, they have access to diagnosis, to getting that sort of help they need. I'm pretty sure that if I had been diagnosed in secondary school or primary school and, you know, went to school and said anything about it, or somebody said anything about it, there wouldn't have been that aha moment where other people had that diagnosis, because we weren't in a place where we had that access to those services. So I completely understand that, yeah, you want to look at the difference between privacy and secrecy, and you don't necessarily want to keep some things a secret. But also we do have to look at where that might be self-protective. And it might be important for people to keep that, you know, keep that diagnosis, keep that there in therapy, keep that there in treatment of some sort, a secret, because it really can affect the way that people perceive you. It can affect employability. If you're not in a place where those things are seen as normal, seen as okay, in terms of, you know, mental health here, employers are not going to want to hire people who have poor mental health. And there's precious little legislation against that. So people aren't going to disclose. They're going to want that to be a secret, and they're going to want that to be a secret for very genuinely important reasons. And then we also have to look at color and the communities that we're talking about, because people who are Black, who are Asian, who are Native American are more likely to be discriminated against due to mental health issues, any sort of divergence from the norm. So, you know, brilliant, yes, talk about it, but be careful, you know, say that with a pinch of salt, because you don't want a kid from a less privileged background feeling, well, yeah, I can disclose this and people are going to be okay with it. You don't really know until you know the situation.
Just briefly confirm, or at least, you know, add on to what Catherine was saying. I teach at a university that I would say 90% of my students are minority. And I used to team teach with a psychology professor about a linguistics class. And we had a student who quite clearly needed some sort of accommodation. And we got a sense of what was happening with him. And we said, look, we can help you. And he said, no, I can't. My parents might find out. And we're from a very traditional country and background. And they would never accept that. And something was similar when I was teaching first semester at the University of West Indies. I had a student who was quite clearly ADHD. And I said, surely there's something that we can do for you here. And the student said, nope, can't do it. My parents don't want to know. It would make a difference in how my professors or the administration treated me. And so while things are available, not all students feel comfortable getting help. What I found myself doing is once it was kind of obvious with the student, even though there was no paperwork or disclosure, I would try to find ways around and alternative ways. The idea that certain people are, you know, allowed to have neurodiversity and certain people aren't is really something that we do. Catherine said we do a lot of work in the margins, and we do. We try to figure out, like, what can we do that isn't either problematic or over healthy and is just right.
And again, that brings up the idea of having to disclose, right? We sort of touched on that and being able to get accommodations, particularly even as academics within our workplace, where this idea that the system is set up not for us in order to get usually accommodations or some sort of assistance. You know, there's a lot of transgressing that has to be done. And there's a lot of advocating that has to be done. And there's a lot of, as I said, paperwork that has to be done. And there's, and even when you do all of that, there is, you know, again, risk that is involved. And so part of the idea is, how can we set up this whole system differently? Something my co-host Amy Morrison actually wrote an article about is this idea of the nature of disclosure. Right. And in an academic setting, because that's the setting that she's in. But again, how our society has set this up, and even, you know, even with physical disabilities, right, is that the norm is you should be able to go upstairs, you should be able to walk across your entire campus in 5 minutes, you should be able to get through these very old narrow doorways, you should be able to. And then, you know, when you do not fit, quite literally, you know, then you're the problem. And so it's this idea of, again, taking a step back and saying, how have we set this all up that we are forcing people into this uncomfortable situation of disclosing, of getting an expensive diagnosis of, and because that's another thing, you know, like you said, Catherine, is that even the access to mental health services right now is really difficult because the demand has gone up. You know, in a lot of cases, you have to pay a lot of money to get these things, and you have to get on wait lists, and you have to have access to those. It's thinking about those systems that are set up that forces individuals into these uncomfortable situations.
Absolutely. I think that this highlights that there's so many different ways to be neurodiverse. I mean, we have one term, but there's infinite ways to be neurodiverse. Neurodiverse is as diverse of a term as people are diverse and situated. So I just want to thank everybody on this call again, Rebecca, Lee, Catherine, for your professional work, for your volunteer work, your community work, your work in education. And if there are any social media details that you want to share with people where they can find you on Twitter, feel free to do that.
I'm Ready Writing on Twitter. My podcast is All the Things ADHD, available on all the major podcasts. Also, the website for it is allthethingsadhd.com. I have a website, readywriting.org, as well. It's more like just my blog, but you can find some of my writing, particularly on mental health there. I have a whole COVID-19 chronicles, you know, writing through the pandemic in that sort of way. But yeah, I'm pretty prolific still on Twitter, even as Twitter is going downhill. Until they tell me where I can find all my friends that I made on Twitter elsewhere, I'm just going to stay on there. So find me at Ready Writing. Give me a holler.
Rebecca, did you want to share anything about Twitter? Are you still accepting people for ADHD and Academy? Is there a place where people can find that? Or
so it's mostly just me. People will DM me on Twitter. So I am Rebecca J. Shapiro on Twitter. And I don't think there's a problem saying, oh, sure, I'll add you to the email list. What I do like is to be able to find people as they exist in the real world. So, you know, if I don't know them personally, could they, you know, message me with their, you know, like an academic email, or like, how can I find you that you're not some sort of crazy rando? and so that's pretty much it. And, you know, people are coming in and trickling and saying, oh, can I join? And I'm like, sure, I'll add you to the list. And there doesn't seem to be a big problem adding people to the list, because at any time, half the people will be doing, you know, something else instead of, you know, at a meeting, which is, you know, normal anyway. So I'll just keep adding people and just we'll keep having meetings and see what happens.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the N4SJA podcast. And you can reach out to us at our email address, narrative4sj@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at @narrative4sj. And our Facebook page is called Narrative for Social Justice.